So yeah, last week we started to, in a way, explore this strange world of physics. We talked a little bit about the Big Bang, didn't we? And we also talked a little bit about the assumptions that physics sort of has in its whole method. And one of the things I was saying is that the Buddha wouldn't have been particularly interested in what physics had to say, at least. He wouldn't have emphasized its importance. When asked about questions about the universe, for example, he was asked, is the universe infinite or is it finite? Is it eternal or not? He dismissed those questions as being, unanswerable. Because the terms of the questions themselves were flawed. But he also said that they weren't really relevant. They weren't really relevant. Because the point was to not speculate about the nature of reality, but to escape from suffering, to free yourself from suffering. Hi, come on in, you two. So there's some space up the front if you want. Or you could get a mat from the back and try and find some space. Let's make some space. So yes, he wasn't that interested in emphasising the nature of reality so much as pointing the way that leads to the end of suffering. And to that degree, he can be said to have been metaphysically reticent. He didn't speculate about metaphysics. He is said to have had no views, for example, no views at all. He is said to have just experienced things as they are, directly, without concepts, without words, without some sort of theory or view, sort of mediating the experience. And what he said is that that experience is the ultimate liberation, and profoundly, it satisfies every yearning that we have as human beings. So it's completely satisfying, it's blissful, it's liberating, it's the state of ultimate wisdom and compassion. But nevertheless, later tradition, the Buddhist tradition, has speculated about the nature of reality. In a way, the Indian mind, I think, was very much one of philosophizing and speculating and building conceptual structures, and then that continued as Buddhism spread into other countries. And I like some of that speculating, because I think that it, for me, it sort of engages and excites my curiosity about what's going on. And physics speculates. Physics is, in a way, what is sort of speculation of a particular nature par excellence. Physics speculates about what's really going on. And all physics consists of models and theories about what's going on in the language of mathematics. And physics is remarkably good at devising theories that have extraordinary predictive power. Extraordinary predictive power and measurable, extraordinary accuracy when measured. Yeah. So physics has got very, very sophisticated and good at being able to predict how things will work or happen. And until the 20th century, in a way, it had models, had really, really good models for what was going on. But the models that it had until the start of the 20th century were, they were models that were based on seeing the universe as a mechanism, as a giant mechanical device, sort of like clockwork. So the stars revolved around the galaxies and the planets revolved around our star, and it was all, the heavens were obeying some sort of mechanism that was likened to a clock, and all the wheels and cogs in that clock just kept everything beautiful and in motion, in perfect harmony. So physics had a mechanistic view of the universe, that it could be analysed into its constituent parts and explained by just finding the laws that made those parts fit together. You could find the laws that made the universe tick. And by the end of the 19th century, physics had pretty much sewn up everything. And in 1894, one very famous physicist called Michelson predicted that physics had pretty much got the answer to everything. And what he said was that all that now remains is to fill in the sixth decimal place in terms of the measurements. You could get a little bit more accurate when your measuring devices and technology got more accurate. All that now remains for physics is to fill in the sixth decimal place. Pretty much, it had everything sewn up. 6 years later, there was a revolution, and Michelson lived to have to eat humble pie, as the world of physics was turned literally on its head by theories and discoveries that just not only didn't fit, but completely overturned the assumptions that physics had had for several hundred years until that point. And one of the fathers of the birth of that revolution was, of course, Einstein. And Einstein, I mean, there's much that I'd like to say about Einstein, but I haven't got time. He worked as a patent agent. He didn't have an academic post. He'd sort of failed to get an academic post in a university. He worked as a patent agent. His maths tutor had said that he was, I don't know exactly the words, but he'd said he was untutorable in maths. Einstein said to have said, in a letter to a young girl, he's said to have said, whatever your difficulties with maths, believe me, mine are greater. And so he was this patent agent working in a day job, in his spare time, he was speculating about the nature of reality. And he wrote three papers in his spare time that completely overturned the world of physics. One of those papers proved, for the first time, sort of proved in ways that physicists could understand and respect, proved the existence of atoms. So atoms had been a speculative kind of theory since the ancient Greeks, maybe, who knows, before. Atom literally means indivisible, or it comes from the Greek meaning indivisible. And so the Greeks had speculated that the whole universe was made ultimately of these tiny, tiny, tiny indivisible particles of matter. But nobody until Einstein had been able to actually show that atoms did exist in a mathematically rigorous way. Anyway, Einstein did that. And it's atoms that I want to look at this week. Next week, well, no, maybe not next week, maybe the week after, we'll look at another revolution that Einstein instigated, which was his theory of relativity, which overturned our notions of space and time. So that was also done in his spare time. The theory of special relativity, the first paper was published around the same time as his theory of atoms. And the other paper that he published in the same year or around the same time was he published a paper about the nature of light and overturned notions that had been around since Newton's time around the nature of light. So he really did just completely turned physics on its head, and it's never recovered since. Yeah, it's never recovered since. So all throughout the early part of the 20th century, for the first 30 years, there was much excitement as this new world opened up. And eventually that became formulated into the theory of quantum physics, quantum theory. Many people sort of contributed to that. So it took about 30 years or so till we had quantum theory. And also we had the theory of relativity, the theory of general relativity. And those two theories still underpin all the physics today. The interesting thing about quantum theory is that nearly 100 years later, nobody still can agree, or people still don't agree as to what it means. So you've got this mathematically, fantastically accurate theory about the ultimate nature of matter, and it works. At least it works in terms of its predictive power, and in terms of its accuracy. It's the most accurate theory that humankind has ever developed. It's a sort of triumph of thought. And it works. It works in the sense that much of our modern technology relies on it. So without quantum theory, you wouldn't have the microchip. You wouldn't actually even have transistors, so you wouldn't have had the transistor radio, but you certainly wouldn't have had computer chips, and so you wouldn't have had the iPad 2, and you wouldn't have had, well, even your dishwasher, without quantum theory. Without quantum theory, we couldn't explain how electricity flows through metals. Without quantum theory, we couldn't explain why the sun shines. Without quantum theory, in a way, we couldn't explain much of what we take for granted in the technological world that we live in. But yes, nobody can really understand, nobody can agree on what it means. And I this morning, I was looking up various things on the internet just to make sure that they hadn't suddenly in my not noticing, that hadn't suddenly become a consensus kind of interpretation. Do you know what I mean? A consensus meaning. And there isn't. There isn't. Right up to this minute, there isn't a consensus. Although there are several different interpretations, some of them more popular than others, and I'll come on to them. Okay, but first of all, I just want to talk about atoms. Atoms are really, 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 really small. And that's why they've taken so long to discover, because they're almost unimaginably tiny, So it's not really possible to, I think, get an intuitive grasp of how small, but we'll give it a go. So if you take a grain of sugar, a brown sugar grain, sort of light demerara brown sugar, and you count the number of atoms there are in that grain of sugar, it doesn't have to be sugar, I guess I'm taking a sort of millimeter cube of stuff, and you count the number of atoms in that stuff, how many do you think you might find, give or take a few million? How many do you think you might find? Billions, yeah. Any advance on billions?
500 billion.
So a billion, remember, can anybody remember what we said a billion was?
1,000 million.
So that's one. If we were to write up a billion, which I might do in a minute, that would be one followed by nine noughts. Yeah? So 500 billion would be 500 times that, yeah? So that would be 500,000 million, yeah? Yeah, no. So, any advances on 500,000 million?
A billion billion?
Yeah, a billion billion. So a billion billion would be 1 followed by 18 noughts. Who said that? A billion. So that's close, but not close enough. It's more like 1,000 billion. Yeah? So that would be 1. I mean, you know, as I say, this isn't... I mean, don't quote me on this if it's wrong. But it's more like 1 followed by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21 noughts. Yeah? So that many atoms, roughly. Can you see the free chart? In
a tiny grain of sugar.
Yeah, so that's really, really small. And then what's incredible is that atoms themselves aren't the smallest thing. So physicists soon discovered that actually atoms were made up of smaller things, smaller particles themselves, and much, much, much smaller. So at the centre of the atom, where most of its mass, where most of the stuff is, there's the nucleus. And then surrounding the nucleus, there's this cloud of very tiny particles called electrons. But the nucleus at the heart is really, really tiny. Really, really tiny. So if you took... if you took a nucleus and you expanded, you blew it up, as it were, to the size of a fly... So that might be a centimetre across, as it were, then the electrons would be flying around it at a distance that's so large that the whole atom would be the size of St. Peter's Dome in Rome, of St. Peter's Church. So it would be this vast dome, would be the whole atom. And the nucleus would just be this tiny bit of this flying around that vast dome. And then the electrons would just be tiny specks whizzing around that dome. Yeah? And in between, there would be nothing. There would literally be empty space. There would be nothing. So most of the atom is just empty. Yeah? Tiny, tiny, tiny thing that's mostly nothing. And we're all made of that. Everything's made of that. Another analogy I came across was that if the nucleus of the atom was a millimetre across, then the atom itself would be the size of the Empire State Building. Yeah, so the electrons would be whizzing around at the top. So again, just it really is almost nothing. In order to see the atoms in a drop of water, you would have to expand the water to a distance, a radius of 24 kilometres. So a drop of water would have to become actually a diameter, I think, of 24 kilometres before you could see those tiny atoms. So we're talking really, really small. Another bit of another analogy I like is if you take a sugar cube this time, a cube, you know, of white sugar that you drop in your tea. The quantum world, the atomic world, is as much smaller to that cube of sugar as the cube of sugar is smaller than the whole observable universe. Yeah, that's the scale of things. So it's like, that's how much smaller we're talking than this kind of cube of sugar. And physicists have explored this atomic world very, very precisely. They've measured things very, very, very precisely. So it's extraordinary that that can happen at all. And it's extraordinary that, that we can say anything about it. But the models that have been developed are bizarre, are really, really bizarre. And that's what I want to look at, or start looking at. But before I look at that, I want to also talk about... So I've got an atom here, or a model of an atom, which was given... Actually, I pinched that from my roommate, but it's now mine. He seems to have been all right about that.
And that's a model of an atom. It's not a very good model of an atom, but it's the best I've got. This is it's just a small bit of stuff. Actually, it's probably better a model as of an electron, because we know that atoms are made of smaller stuff. But this could be just an electron. Yeah. So that's your electron. But physics also says that energy arises not just in terms of particles, but also in terms of waves. Waves. So the energy of the universe isn't all in matter, it's also in waves. By waves, we mean sort of undulating motion in some sort of medium, like water. Yeah? So ripples or waves in water, or sound waves are sort of pressure waves in air, aren't they? That's what sound is. And light is this undulating motion in a more abstract medium called the electromagnetic field. So light is a wave in the electromagnetic field. And I've got something here which I'd like to demonstrate as waves. So, Vanaraji, I wonder if you'd stand up and come to the front. So this is a wave-making thing. If you hold that end and move back, so we stretch out as much as we can. And I just want you to look at the waves in this thing. There you go. There, that's great, isn't it? Can you see that? Just about. It's a bit fast, isn't it? And what can you say about the waves as opposed to this atom? They're both forms of energy, but what's the difference? Or some of the differences?
The waves moving,
whereas this, well, in my hand, is stationary, and you can say that it's in this place, I'm holding it. Whereas this wave is sort of defined by a movement. Without movement, it isn't a wave. Yeah? So the wave's moving, yeah. What else?
There's no fixed shape to it.
Yeah.
It's constantly in flux.
It's constantly in flux, so there's no fixed form to it. Now, you can sort of start to fix it if I get it right, but it's still flowing. Anything else?
The wave needs the medium. The wave is not that string.
Right. The wave is energy in the spring somehow. It's travelling through the spring. Yeah? The wave is just sort of energy in the spring. It's not possible to sort of point to it and say, this is the wave. It's the energy in the spring, in a way. The other thing is that the wave is spread out in space, isn't it? So as Vanaraji jiggles her hand, you see the wave moving, and it's spread out across the whole spring. Yeah? Whereas the atom, or the particle, is in one place in my hand. It's sort of, if it was much, much smaller, you could pinpoint it literally and say, here it is. Whereas the wave is all completely spread out over space. And if this spring was much longer, the wave could be spread out, in theory, over the whole of space. Yet there's no limit or boundary, in theory, to where it is. It's just a spreading out of energy moving in this rippling, kind of undulating motion. And you see that, don't you? You drop a pebble in a pond, and the waves spread out. And they only stop when they reach the edge of the pond, and then they might bounce back or ripple back or something. Yeah.
Could you say that the atom is in, I see it, as it's something internal, whereas the wave is something external?
Internal in what sense, or external in what sense?
Well, the atom seems to be complete in itself.
Right.
Whereas the wave is a very external thing.
It's certainly spread out, isn't it? It's spread out. But in a way, they're both external, if you like, because they're both out there.
I understand.
Yeah. Okay, so the reason that I'm sort of highlighting those things is that until the 19th, well, until the 20th century, physicists were quite happy to explain all phenomena in the universe as energy in the form of particles or waves. Yeah? And they're sort of one or the other. So light was thought to be a wave motion. Electrons were thought to be particles. Yeah? And that started to all unravel and be overturned, as I say, in the 20th century. So what I'm going to talk you through is an experiment that, in a way, starts to point at the heart of the mystery of quantum physics. It's an experiment that ends in paradox and is difficult to interpret. And yet, it's an experiment that can be done in the lab very, very easily, and in fact is still done today. Yeah? So I'm going to explain it on a flip chart, and then later we'll have we look at a film of the experiment with... well, I'll say more about the film in a minute. Okay, so the first thing you have to do is... can everybody see that? Can everybody see that? So what I've got here is... an experimental setup, where you've got in red this little source of waves. You've got some sort of waves, they could be water waves, or here I've drawn it a bit like a light bulb, and they're light waves. So you've got this red source of waves, so these waves are coming out of this thing, whatever it is. And then you've got this green line here with a gap in the green line just in front of the red source. And what this is it's a screen with a hole in. So most of the waves are going to get blocked by the screen. But the hole is going to let through whatever waves can be got through the hole. Yeah? What happens when you have a little hole and waves... going through it, is that the waves spread out. They spread out in sort of circular arcs, yeah, like ripples in a pond. They're spreading out in bigger and bigger arcs. And then here, I've got another screen that's blocking those ripples, but that this screen now has two holes in it. Yeah? A top hole and a bottom hole. And so now what you get is you get, from each of these holes, it seems as if you get another source of spreading out waves. Yeah? You get ripples spreading out from now two sources near each other. And what happens is that the waves cross over each other. They flow through each other. So if you imagine a pond and you dropped two pebbles in, you'd get two sets of ripples spreading out, and they'd overlap, because ripples and waves can pass through each other. Unlike particles, which will bounce off each other, waves can flow through each other. And what happens is that you get this pattern of interfering waves. So waves have peaks and troughs, don't they? They have crests and troughs. And what happens is that when you get two waves meeting each other, sometimes they're both at their crest, at their peak, and they meet each other. And then you get a bigger crest, a double crest. Sometimes one wave is at a crest, but the other wave is in the trough, and they cancel each other out, and you get nothing. And sometimes both waves will be in their trough, and they sort of add up together to form a bigger trough. Yeah? So you get this adding up effect, this interference effect, which is what I've tried to show by this overlapping pattern of arcs. And then, on this side, I've got a screen which is going to detect any waves that hit
this screen. So if this was light, then this screen could be a photographic plate that can detect any light that hits it. Yeah? And what you get when you do this experiment is that you get a pattern on this photographic plate. You get a pattern of bands of light and dark. And the biggest bit of light, the biggest light band, is right in the centre here. And I've shown it as this red line. The red line is showing how bright is the light that hits that spot. And so the bigger the bump here, the brighter the light band is there. So you get a band of light, then you get a band of dark, then you get a band of light but little less bright than the central band, then a band of dark, and then another band of bright light but less bright than these two, band of dark. So you get these what are called fringes or bands of light and dark. Yeah? Because these waves have overlapped and form this pattern, this crisscrossing pattern where they've added up and things. Yeah? So this is the telltale sign that light is a wave. It's because a man called Young did this experiment that he showed through this experiment that light was a wave. Before he did this, there was some dispute. Some people thought light might consist of particles. There might be particles, small little bits of light that are shooting across space. But Young did this experiment with a light bulb and got these bands of fringes, and that showed that light was actually a wave. Yeah? So from that time in the 19th century, light was definitely a wave. So let's leave it there. Does everybody understand this so far? Yeah? Light behaving as waves. And it's not just light, it's any sort of waves. So water would do this if you had ripples in a pond. Yeah? Any sort of wave would do this. Okay, let's break for tea, and then we'll come back and see what happens next. Okay, very good. So are you ready for some more? So far we haven't actually got to anything quantum, so don't... If you don't understand this, then shout now before it gets more complicated, because you won't stand a chance later on. So this is just saying how waves behave when passing through two holes. They're called slits in Young's famous experiment. This is Young's double slit experiment for the two slits. Now we're going to look at what happens when particles pass through holes. Yeah? Here, this looks a lot more straightforward, doesn't it? Here I've got a source of particles. It could be a bit of radioactive material that's firing little bits of particles. Or you could imagine that somebody's standing there throwing rocks or marbles at this screen. And this screen's got a hole in. I've labelled it this time, that's A. And most of the particles are going to hit the screen and not go through. And then some of them are going to go through the hole. Yeah? And the hole's a little bit bigger than the particles. So some of them will go through sort of directly through the centre of the hole. Some of them will be a bit of an angle, but they'll still get through. Yeah? And then here, you've got this screen again that's going to detect every particle as it lands. And what you'll get is that most of them will land around here, but they'll form a bit of a pile around there because they'll have come through at different angles. Yeah? So if it was rocks being fired at a hole in the wall, then you'd get a pile of rocks landing somewhere the other side of the wall. Does that make sense? Yeah? That's not too complicated, is it? So what you've got there is particles going through one hole. And then what the physicists did was replace the screen with two holes. So now you've got two slits, A and B. And the particles should go through, some of them go through the top slit, and some of them should go through the bottom slit. And others will just be blocked by this screen. So what you'd expect is that you'd get two piles of particles, one somewhere up here if they've gone through the top slit, and one somewhere down there if they've gone through the bottom slit. Slit A, slit B. Yeah? So what physicists did was they opened up these two slits, and they're firing these particles through them. And one of the particles you could fire is electrons, but you could also fire other particles, atoms or I don't know, other particles. You could fire them through. And they expected to see this, but instead they saw this, that the particles didn't land in two neat piles, one here and one down there. Instead, they landed in places that were typical of a wave interference pattern. So the most number of particles landed there. Yeah? And there is directly in the middle of these two slits. Like, nothing should get through to there if it was a particle. Do you see what I mean? Because particles go in straight lines. Remember, the waves spread out in huge curves and arcs, and then those curves and arcs overlapped and formed patterns. But particles just go in straight lines when you throw them. Yeah? Well, that's what you'd expect. And so you'd expect these two piles, and instead you get this interference pattern, which is characteristic of waves. So as soon as you open these two slits, it's like they're behaving like waves. But when you only have one slit open, you don't get this spreading out. They just follow this straight line and end up like well-behaved particles. Yeah? So that's a bit weird, isn't it? Because you kind of think, hang on, I've just opened another slit. As far as one of these particles going through the top slit is concerned, it doesn't even know that there's another hole below it. So it's changing its behaviour. Yeah. So then the physicists thought, okay, this is really, really weird. Perhaps what's happening is that somehow, let's call it an electron, is there's a whole beam of electrons, a whole heap of particles, and maybe they're interfering with each other somehow. Do you see what I mean? There's a whole swarm of electrons coming through. Maybe they're interfering with each other and deflecting each other and somehow mysteriously landing in places that would indicate they were waves. Yeah? Because when they land on the screen, they behave like well-behaved particles again. You get a little pinprick there, or a pinprick there, but you get none there. Yeah? Because that's where a wave wouldn't land. So what they did was they slowed this particle machine down so that only one electron at a time would go through. So one electron would go through. That means it had nothing else to interfere with, to interact with. But it would land either there or there or there or there, but not there or there. So when you allowed this experiment to run over a few hours and more electrons went through, you got these bands of light and dark patterns again.
Was it only through one hole, or were you still between?
Both holes were open.
But only one?
Both holes were open.
And one going through each, or one?
Well, that's a question. So then they were saying, is it that this electron is mysteriously, sort of somewhere around there, splitting itself into two, going through both holes, interfering with itself on the other side, somehow that interference pattern deflecting it, then landing in well-behaved particle fashion, as if it was only one particle, but somehow landing in a place that it could only land if it had interfered with itself? Yeah? So that was one kind of notion, that maybe that's what's happened. It's done this spooky, splitting, interfering thing. But then they thought, oh no, well, tell you what we'll do is we'll see. Is it going through both holes like that? Or is it just going through the top hole? Or is it going through the bottom hole? Yeah? And what you can do is you can put detectors in the way. You can put a detector and say, I'll put this detector here, and that will, I don't know, cause some sort of bleep if the particle is going through hole B. Because if it's going through hole B, it'll pass through this detector. Yeah? You could put another detector there, or you don't have to, because as soon as you know it's gone through B, then you know it hasn't gone through A. Or if you don't see it go through B, then you know that it has gone through A. Yeah? So you just need kind of one detector to say, has it gone through this slit or not?
What if it's gone through both?
Well, then you could put another detector in, but let's ignore that for the moment. So they put a detector in just to see whether the particle... Well, I'll draw that in. So you could put another detector in. So this detector system would now detect whether it's gone through A or B or both. Yeah? Soon as you put a detector in that can tell has it gone through A or B or both, you lose this interference pattern, and they behave as well-behaved normal particles. And they land either there or there, but not in both places. So they either go through A or they go through B, and they behave just as rocks would or marbles would or, you know, particles should. So they behave normally, but if you don't look and say, are you going through slit A or are you going through slit B, then you get this interference pattern. But only when the detectors aren't there. Now then they thought, oh, maybe the detectors are interfering with the path of the particles in some mysterious way. You can have very sophisticated versions of this experiment where the detectors detect the path indirectly. They never actually touch the particle. You can do that. It's too complicated to explain for now. But as soon as you have knowledge of which slit the particle went through, it behaves as a particle and only goes through one of them. If you don't have knowledge of which slit it went through, it behaves as a wave, interferes with itself somehow, and then resumes its particle identity when it hits the screen. But because it's behaved as a wave in the meantime, it only lands in places that a wave could land. Yeah? So it has this telltale sign of waves, and yet behaves as a particle. So this is weird enough, isn't it? This is weird enough. Wheeler, a physicist called Wheeler, said, let's be really, really clever, and let's set up an experiment where we let the electron pass through these slits before deciding whether to detect it or not. So we'll let it get to this point, and then randomly we'll decide whether we can put a detector in the way or not. Yeah? And so if it's got to this point, it's gone through either one slit or the other slit or both slits. Do you see what I mean? It's too late, basically, but it's already gone through. So this is called Wheeler's delayed choice experiment of Young's double slits. Delayed choice. So you make the choice, but you delay making the choice until you know that it's already passed through. Really complex experiment to set up technically, but you can do it, and it's been done. And what happens is that even after the electron has passed through this point, if you decide to detect it, it will behave as a particle, as if it's only gone through one slit. If you decide not to detect it, it will behave as a wave, as if it's gone through both slits. Yeah? But it's already gone through the slits by the time you decide. It's as if it retrospectively sort of goes back and says, oh, there's a particle detector there, I better behave as a particle, that would mean only going through one slit or the other. Or it says, oh, there's no particle detector there, it's safe to go through both slits and interfere with myself and be a wave. Yeah? As if that's what it's saying. It's as if it somehow knows what you're doing. Which is when physicists don't talk like this, so they just think this is well, most of the time, most physicists just ignore this sort of paradox, but it points to the heart of something that says we don't know what an electron is. We don't actually now know whether it's a wave or a particle or both, because it seems to behave as either. And what's worse is that it seems to behave as either depending on what we choose to measure. If we want to measure a particle, it'll behave as a particle. If we want to measure a wave, it'll behave as a wave. And remember, waves and particles are very, very different things. So particles have one particular location and they move in space like a rock or a ball. Waves are spread out over all of space, and they can go through two holes. Particles can't. Waves can interfere with each other, overlap, form patterns. Particles just bounce off each other. And an electron does both. Yeah? So that's weird enough. And then what physicists found is that not only does an electron behave like this, all particles behave like this. All particles have this dual nature of being waves sometimes or particles sometimes, depending on what you look for. And then they also realized that this applied to light. So remember, light was said to be a wave. And they realized that actually everything that they thought of as a wave before also can behave as a particle. So what you've got is this mysterious world where now you can't picture the electron. Because those two models of wave and particle are mutually exclusive. And it can be either or somehow both. So the question is, what happens in this experiment, in this region? We know what's happening here, and we know what's happening here, but what's happening inside here? Is this thing a wave or a particle when we're not looking? Yeah? And that remains a mystery. And that's the thing that physicists don't have any agreed interpretation about. Yeah? What they know is that when you measure it, it will behave like this. But when you're not looking, physicists don't have an agreed interpretation of what's going on when you're not looking. Yeah? Now, one interpretation, which is called the Copenhagen interpretation, because Niels Bohr, who was mainly behind this interpretation, was a Dane. He was called the Great Dane. And he had this long-running... He was a contemporary of Einstein. And Bohr and Einstein were friends who had this long-running dispute about quantum mechanics, about quantum physics. Einstein never got reconciled to quantum physics. He could never accept this weirdness and what's going on. Or he couldn't accept the interpretations of it. Whereas Bohr embraced it. And what Bohr said was that when you're not looking at the electron, it's meaningless to say anything about it. It's meaningless to say, is it really a wave or is it really a particle when you're not looking? When you're not looking, it's as if you can't say anything about it. It only makes sense to talk of an electron in the context of you looking. It only makes sense to talk about it in the context of an experimental setup. And when you look in a particular way, you'll see a particle. And when you look in another sort of way, you'll see a wave. When you're not looking, it's impossible to say if it's there, if it is there, what is it? Yes, it's impossible to say anything about it. It's as if you're part of the whole apparatus, and it only makes sense when you talk about the whole apparatus together with you looking. So Einstein said rubbish. He said, that's tantamount to saying that reality isn't out there. Yeah?
Quite right.
So Einstein's saying that that challenges the whole notion of an observable, objective reality. Objective reality, sorry, not an observable one. It challenges this whole notion of an objective reality. And Bohr says, yes, it does. And he leaves it at that. He doesn't tell you, in a way, the Copenhagen interpretation doesn't tell you what's out there. It just says, this is what we can measure. And when you measure in a particular way, you'll see this. When you measure in another way, you'll see that. But you will never know what's out there when you weren't looking. Yeah? So, you know, Einstein was saying, that's tantamount to saying, does the moon exist when you don't look at it? And Bohr would sort of shrug, as it were. I don't know what he actually did. But you see what I mean? The Copenhagen interpretation just doesn't say anything about does the moon really exist when you're not looking. Yeah. So this starts to challenge at the very, very heart of what physics is trying to do. It's challenging the notion of an objective universe. Now, I'm going to play this 5-minute video just that will run through this experiment one more time. I think it's just worth listening to it again because it goes to the heart of everything in quantum physics. And this is a cartoon video from a series called Dr. Quantum. And it's just 5 minutes. It's a bit cheesy. So did that make sense? I mean, not make sense, you know what I mean? Did that not make sense in the right way? So one of the things he said on that little film, Dr. Quantum, was he referred to probability, yeah? And this is an essential kind of aspect of quantum physics. What quantum physics is saying is that there's a probability that there's a probability that the electron will go through the top slit. There's a probability that it will go through the bottom slit. There's a probability that it will go through neither. And there's a probability that it will go through both. And this Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics says that all there is are those probabilities. And when you're not looking, all those probabilities are equally real. They're all happening somehow. So when you're not looking, it is going through the top slit only, and it's also going through the bottom slit only. And it's also going through neither slit, and it's also going through both slits, as if it were a wave. All those probabilities are actually happening. But when you look, one of those probabilities becomes an actuality. It's like those probabilities exist in some way, and then one of them becomes actual. One of those different probabilities collapse into one reality. So the film referred to the collapse of the wave function. It's like, until you look, they're all equally real, if you like, and then one becomes an actuality. That's another aspect of quantum physics. So what it's saying, if you take this interpretation of Copenhagen, interpretation, then it's saying that the world out there, independent of us, at least at the level of quantum particles, it's not so much as it's actually out there as it's probably out there. Yeah. Somehow what exists is this realm of probabilities, and then as soon as we look, one of them becomes so real. Yeah, that's the Copenhagen interpretation, which, as I say, starts to, well, it undermines the notion of an objective world out there. It also undermines the notion that of determinism. Because what it's doing is it's saying that things only probably happen. They don't definitely happen. There's no way of definitely saying it'll go through one slit or the other or both or neither. There's only probabilities. And Einstein was really railing against this notion that physics, all that physics could say is things will probably happen and predict how probable, how likely the happening was. He said, no, there must be real laws that are deterministic. Do you see what I mean? Clocks don't probably tick. They either tick or they don't, and they'll tick if they're wound up and not if they're not. They won't probably suddenly decide to go backwards. They'll always go forwards, etc., etc. So Einstein was saying, no, there are absolute laws that govern the universe in an entirely predictable way, and that's what's called determinism. It's a sort of philosophical position that physics had. Whereas post-quantum physics, determinism is on much more shaky or questionable ground. It's been replaced by this world of probabilities, these ghostly probabilities that somehow all exist at once and even affect each other until one of them becomes a reality. So let me just pause there and see if there are any questions, first of all. Yes. I was hoping there wouldn't be, but I'll pick you first, Tom.
Do we know the outcome of increasing the number of poles
beyond two? Beyond two. I've never seen any experiment done beyond two. It's almost as if two's enough to highlight this weirdness. And if you had three, I'm pretty certain the same thing would happen, that you'd have wave behaviour if you didn't know which slit they were going through, and particle behaviour if you did. So two is the sort of minimum. Yeah. Actually, there are experiments that are to do with diffraction gratings where you've got multiple slits. You could say that they've got multiple holes, so yes. Well, it doesn't change this paradox. It doesn't change the paradox. You get more complex patterns, basically. You get more complex patterns at the other end, but not wouldn't change this weirdness of something behaving as a wave if you're not looking as to which slit it goes through, and behaving as a particle if you look and if you know. Yeah. Go on.
Does it make any difference if you have two observers doing the
experiment simultaneously? No. As soon as you gather knowledge as to which slit or neither that it's gone through, as soon as you score which way information, as soon as you know which way the electron's gone, no matter how you've observed it or how many observers, as soon as it's possible to know, then it will behave only in a well-behaved particle kind of way.
So they both always get the same results?
Yeah. Alison.
Well, it's just that I can't help thinking that there has to be some kind of observation.
In observation, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, and I sort of think it sounds as though physicists assume that because they have a device where they can't measure any energetic field, that they need to feel they assume it's not there. That's all.
Well, it's interesting. So this experiment leads physicists to say, what is it about the act of observation that changes reality? And
physicists have tended to assume that the observer doesn't affect reality, that reality is happening and the observer is somehow a passive observer that just observes, as it were. But actually what this sort of experiment starts to show is that perhaps the observer is more like a participant in forming reality, rather than this neutral, passive recorder of reality. Do you see what I mean? An active participant.
Now, physicists. Well.
Yes. Now, physicists don't have any notion of that sort of energy. Yeah. So one of the things that physicists don't have any notion of is consciousness apart from as a phenomenon arising out of matter. Yeah? So most physicists, if they only believe in physics, I mean, if they're religious, they might have other beliefs as well, but if they only believe in physics, they'd say that consciousness is just a byproduct of brain function, and brain function is just neurons firing in particular patterns. Just, I mean, of course, that's a very complicated system. But nevertheless, what they'd say is that consciousness is just brain function, and therefore it's just matter. Everything is just matter. They don't have a notion of consciousness as somehow being special or different to matter. What I find interesting is that even if you accept that physics kind of assumption, what you start to find is paradox. Yeah? You start to find paradox. You start to find things that can't be easily explained just with those assumptions. So I find that interesting. I find that really interesting. And what I like to... I mean, one of the reasons that I'm doing this is because I think that doing this seminar is that I think in our culture, in our popular culture, there's a strong undercurrent of scientific materialism. Not that we're all very consciously holding that view, but in our culture, that's quite a common assumption, that matter is all there is, that we are just our bodies, that consciousness is just brain function, that means that when the body dies, the lights go out, we're dead. That's all that life is. One of the implications of that worldview, it's a nihilist worldview, isn't it? And the Buddha was saying that that's a wrong worldview. That's not how things are. Nihilism is somehow wrong. One of the implications of a nihilistic worldview can be that, well, if this is all there is, if the body is all there is, you might as well try and just have as much pleasure as you can while you've got it. Yeah? Which sort of then supports our consumerism, our hedonism, our lack of concern for the environment, for each other, for the well-being of the planet, and for people on the other side of the planet. It can all start to become rather self and self-centered and present tense oriented. We just go for the most pleasure now, the instant gratification. We reach for whatever it will give us that. Now, I'm not saying that that's the only... that chain of reasoning always follows. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's prevalent in our culture, and it's prevalent to the degree that I think is really dangerous. Well, it is dangerous, isn't it? In that you look at what our culture is doing. Not just our culture, I mean modern culture. Yeah. The modern world. It's prevalent in that. So I find it interesting, if you're going to be a materialist, well, at least be a real materialist and look at the fact that physics doesn't know what matter is. That matter is much, 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 much more mysterious than common sense implies. Common sense notions of marbles and smaller bits of marbles and things don't apply anymore, and what's more, they haven't done so for about 100 years. Yeah, so let's catch up with our notions of what's going on, because physicists have been saying this for 100 years, that oh, we don't really know what's going on. Yeah,
So I like that sense of wonder that can encourage in us. I mean, the Buddhist worldview, Subhuti was talking about this when he was giving his rambles on imagination last year. The Buddhist worldview is that there's no such thing as dead, inert matter. The Buddhist worldview is that the universe is somehow alive, and everything is somehow alive and living. Yeah? To different degrees, sure, to different degrees of vitality, different degrees of conscious capability, etc. But there's no such point at which you can say it's dead, or not alive, or completely inert. Even a rock is, from a Buddhist point of view, somehow alive, full of potential that is more realized in, say, us. Yeah? So nothing's inert, which is quite different to a scientific materialist worldview. It's almost a polar opposite to a scientific materialist worldview. From a Buddhist perspective, consciousness is primary. So science, physics, gives weight to matter and says that the world is really just constructed from matter, and consciousness doesn't exist really as a separate phenomenon. It's just a phenomenon of matter. Buddhism traditionally comes from the other extreme, or the other opposite pole, and says actually consciousness is primary. And what we see of as matter is just somehow a manifestation of consciousness, not the other way around. So the fact that we have bodies is a manifestation of our consciousness, not the other way around. Yeah? It's quite a different worldview. So I just like exploring in a way where this worldview and the Buddhist worldview are sort of either meeting or at least both running into paradox.
What about a dead body not being... Nothing is inert, so what's happening with that dead body? It's decaying, so it's not inert?
Well, it's not alive in the same way as it was when it was alive, is it? And it's not like Buddhists believe in sort of zombies or something like that, that the dead bodies are going to come and grab you in the night. It's not like that either. It's more mysterious. When I say alive, I'm talking about a spectrum. Yeah? A spectrum. So plants exhibit less life and consciousness than animals. Human beings seem to exhibit greater consciousness than simple animals. Rocks seem to exhibit so little of this that we call them inert. But Buddhism would say, well, no, they're just further down the spectrum of what it is to be animated with consciousness, with life. Yeah? There's no limit. So a dead body, as it were, no longer has the same life animating it. It no longer has a life force animating. But it still is matter. And from a Buddhist perspective, that matter is somewhere on that spectrum. Yeah? Nothing's completely dead. It's all actually the same stuff somehow. Yeah? Yeah.
Is there an idea that consciousness limits reality in some way, though? Because we were talking,
Right.
Were you suggesting that this world of kind of simultaneous probability...
Yeah.
Is kind of more real than this world limited by perception in which one thing either happens or doesn't happen?
I don't know if it's more real. It's like somehow that's all that you can say when you don't look. You see, what's happening here, I mean, if you step back to the methods of physics, physics deals with equations, mathematical equations. And at the level of mathematical equations, you can write out all these probabilities, and they all make sense on the page. But when you then say, well, what's going on? You have to translate those equations into models that make sense of reality. And that's where physicists don't really know what to do.
Yeah. But does that suggest that there is a kind of transcendent realm beyond those kind of models?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I would say that it does seem to suggest that, but not all physicists would go there. Yeah? Most physicists would now say, let's not ask those questions, and let's get on with our day jobs, which is doing these equations or doing the experiments or whatever. Let's not question what reality is. Let's leave that to the philosophers and the religious people. Physicists tend not to worry too much on a daily basis as to what's going on. Yeah? But nevertheless, there are different interpretations. I'm going to come on to another interpretation in a minute. Yeah.
So if these ideas appeared about 100 years ago, then didn't they also have an impact on other fields, for example, anthropology, the significance of the observer, and also in literature?
Yeah, I think they've been a bit slow in having an impact outside their field. So these days you've got Brian Cox globetrotting around the world, haven't you, and everybody's watching him talking about the nature of reality, the nature of the cosmos, etc. But that's relatively recent. I think that some of these ideas are so subtle, and the maths behind them is quite complex, so not everybody, unless they've studied maths for many years, will understand the maths. But somehow it's more than the maths being difficult, it's that the ideas are so subtle and counterintuitive that they don't seem to have entered into popular discourse in other areas. So I'm thinking of other sciences. I'm thinking of biology, for example, and medicine. Yeah, as far as I'm aware, even today, most biologists and medics have quite a materialist view of what the body is or what matter is. Yeah, they have quite not a materialist view. They have quite a 19th century view of that, a sort of mechanistic view. That's what I'm trying to say. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So the body is seen as a complex machine. And to some degree, that works. To some degree, it works, doesn't it? Well, to a large degree. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just going to say, is that just possibly just because of the scale of things? Right?
That's interesting.
The scale, the
yes. So next week, we're going to come on to this. Yes. So I think it's a really important question, this scale of things. So we've already said that electrons are unimaginably small. Yeah? And at that scale of things, it's not easy to say whether they exist or don't exist, whether they're really there or probably there, etc., etc. But when you look around at the world around us, the flip chart definitely seems to be there. Yeah? You seem to be there. The mat and the cushions under you, the chair under you, seems to be there. The macroscopic world doesn't seem to disappear when we're not looking, does it? It doesn't seem to. And what's more, it seems to behave in a very, very predictable way. So one of the paradoxes is, physics says that everything's made up of atoms, and atoms are made up of these smaller particles. And these smaller particles behave in such a mysterious way that we can't even say they're there, definitely there. So why then does the world of macroscopic things appear to be there all the time? Where's the transition, do you see what I mean, between this microscopic world which behaves so mysteriously and this macroscopic world which seems to obey common sense? Where's that transition? And nobody knows. Nobody seems to know what's really going on. Why does anything macroscopic seem to exist? Yeah?
But isn't the crucial point also that the macro world is made up of those microscopic particles, so they're
yes.
not two separate
yes.
things?
That's right. So that's what I'm saying. So why then does the microscopic world behave so differently to the macroscopic? So differently that you can't even say it's objectively existent. So differently that the observer or the act of observation seems to influence.
But you keep on saying the observer. What we're talking about is pieces of machinery.
No, we're talking about this.
You know, there's no human eye that can see it. So
that's right.
So what's even more puzzling is how something made out of metal, glass, whatever.
Exactly.
But it's
it's a detector. It's an object, isn't it?
This is an inanimate object.
So, but the interesting thing there is, the interesting thing there is the piece of machinery in itself doesn't seem to cause the collapse of this probable world into actuality. It seems to be that you can have pieces of machinery there, but as long as you're not capable of getting information from those pieces of machinery, then it behaves in this mysterious way. It's when the piece
of machinery is switched off.
Then it will behave mysteriously like a wave. If the machinery was switched off, that's a good way of putting it. It's only when the machinery is capable of yielding information about which slit it went through that it changes its behaviour and goes through one of the other slits. So that's really weird, isn't it? What is it? What you're hinting at is really important, because the technical question is, what collapses the wave function? Is it the machinery, or is it the observer, the act of observation? Yeah. Now, it's not obvious to physicists what does collapse the wave function. It's called the measurement problem in quantum physics. And next week we'll come on to some paradoxes that arise from it. Yeah. If it is the act of observation, well, what is it about observation?
The machinery is an extension of our brain functions.
Yeah.
So can they be seen as different from, it's a projection of our mind?
Excuse me, yes they can. And I would support is very...
Let's not... I don't want to get into a debate. I want to... Let's keep it as question and answers, and I want to address that question first. So can the piece of machinery be seen as independent of the observer, and therefore the mind of the observer? And different interpretations seem to say different things, yeah? So there's the Copenhagen interpretation, which says, no, the piece of machinery isn't separate from the observer and the mind of the observer, that the whole thing, including the observer and his or her consciousness, is part of this apparatus, yeah? Then there are other interpretations which say, don't be so silly, that can't be true. There's definitely an objective world out there that's nothing, that's going on independently of the observer. And probably it's the machinery or something else in this experimental setup that's collapsing the wave function. That's another interpretation which has other consequences, which I'm going to come on to next week. If you want, the key thing is, do we want to preserve realism? Realism is a technical word for an objective world out there that's independent of the observer. It's really out there. Yeah? If you want to preserve realism, then the Copenhagen interpretation isn't very good. Yeah? Because it starts to undermine that notion of realism. If you do want to preserve realism, then you need another interpretation. And there are other interpretations, and they are extremely weird, and I'm going to come back to them next week. All that I can say at the moment, what I will say at the moment, is that if you want to preserve realism, then common sense also has to go out the window. No interpretation of quantum physics preserves common sense. Yeah? Everything, every interpretation says, no, there's something weirder going on. Maybe I'll just touch on this other interpretation which preserves realism. The interpretation is called the many worlds interpretation. Have you heard of the many worlds interpretation? So the many worlds interpretation says that these probabilities out there, these probabilities of going through one slit or the other or both or neither, it's not that the observer makes one of them happen in a reality, into reality. But they all become real but each of them becomes real in a separate universe. So every time there's a choice to be made, like do I go through the top slit, the bottom slit, both slits, neither, the universe splits into many versions of itself, parallel versions of itself. And in one universe, it really will go through the top slit. In another one, it will go through the bottom slit. In another one, it will go through both. In another one, it will go through minor. And you and me, also, the whole universe, are part of that split. Do you see what I mean? In one universe, you'll observe it. In another one, you won't. And in the universe that you don't, it behaves as a wave. In the universe that you do. So that's happening, according to the many worlds interpretation, every time anything has a choice to be made. Any particle or anything. So that means that in effect, there are an infinite number of parallel universes. In some of them, you're sitting here now listening to me. In others, you're having a night off and going to the cinema. In others, you'll be relaxing in the bath. In others, you might not have even been born. Yeah? But they're all happening, because every probability at every juncture is actualized in another universe. Yeah? And they're all equally real. So that is a way of preserving realism. Of saying that... I'll come back to you in a second. Oh, I might do. This many worlds interpretation is now... When I studied physics 25 years ago, the Copenhagen interpretation was the standard model that was taught to undergraduates in universities. It was the interpretation that most physicists held to, even though they didn't necessarily like it or understand it. These days, I'm told that the majority of physicists seem to favour the many worlds interpretation. So I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who knows a philosopher and physicist at Oxford, and he was talking to this Oxford professor who said, yes, we think we've sorted out this whole measurement problem. It's now sort of done and dusted, and the answer is the many worlds interpretation. Yeah? Apparently Stephen Hawking is an advocate of the many worlds interpretation. Now, the difference, some many worlds theories, no, some physicists don't take the parallel universes completely literally. They say, well, mathematically, it sort of works. On paper, it sort of works that there are multiple universes. But don't take that too literally. Other physicists take it literally and say, no, that is what reality is. Those that don't take it too literally, well, I think what they say is that you can't say anything about reality. The maths works, and that's enough. Neither of which seems a very satisfactory answer, does it? So there are two interpretations. There are other interpretations. I'm not going to go into them, mainly because I don't really understand them. But the many worlds interpretation, as I say, is certainly in England, probably internationally. There was a survey done in the 90s where most physicists said they favoured the many worlds interpretation. The Copenhagen interpretation lags behind somewhere, and there are other interpretations. None of them preserve common sense. Yeah? None of them preserve common sense.
The big question is, I think, the theory is right, then. How come we are not aware of it?
How come we're not aware of what? Of
let's say if we exist in other
dimensions. Yeah, what they say, the many...
We can't have...
Well, part of the many... Yeah, well, part of the many worlds theory is that the different universes can't communicate with each other. So you'll never know. You'll never know. Because right this minute, there are an infinite number of universes spawning off. In one of them, you never ask that question. And never will you know, because they can't communicate. Yeah, they're not. Yeah.
How many of these interpretations, do they go beyond matter?
mineral, they all stick in matter being the ultimate reality. So I know that, for example, they try and find the smaller and smaller particle that is actually reality. The Copenhagen one sounds to me as if
the Copenhagen
is
one is loosening that. I think it's saying that when you get right down to that tiniest level, it's no longer possible to say, there it is, and it's real, and it's there, and, you know, to say, to touch it, or whatever. Now, it does have still predictable kind of behaviours, but it's much more ghostly and probabilistic. And so, for example, one of the things that the Copenhagen interpretation would say is that the electron is more like a field of probabilities, and it actually exists everywhere in the entire universe all at once. When you look, when you look for it, it manifests in one place. But when you're not looking, it's everywhere. Yeah, which is a lovely poetic kind of interpretation. No wonder a lot of physicists don't like it. No wonder they prefer, a lot of physicists, to preserve this notion that the electron is somewhere. But one of the costs of that is that you have to say, in the many worlds interpretation anyway, that it's, there's an infinite number of universes. Yeah? One more, and then we've got an Eva.
You said at the beginning that there's the atom and there's just nothing
between. Empty space.
Yeah. Still
yeah, true. That still holds true. The majority of the atom, it's 99.9999 probably percent empty space. There's nothing there. Yeah. One of the things that maybe we'll touch on next week is that one of the things that the Buddha said about the nature of conditioned existence is that it's insubstantial, that there's no ultimate entity behind things. There's no fixed self or entity behind things. It's not like everything can be reduced to electrons or quarks or atoms. Matter can't be reduced in that way. The Buddha said that everything is insubstantial, without inherent selfhood. And some interpretations of physics start to, come very close to that. Okay, we really must leave it because it's 1:45, just gone. So come back next week and we'll explore this weirdness a little more.